and gentlemen, welcome to this third edition of the ELT Upgraders podcast with myself, John Craft. I am the Professional Development Manager for Macmillan Education based here in Asia. And I'm in Shanghai office today with Mr. Jakey Wooden, who is our
regional Asia trainer, but basically working in East Asia, Japan, China, Korea, and occasionally Southeast Asia.
Very nice indeed, Jakey. Now, we've got a bit of a special edition today. So we have some special guests. Who are our special guests, Jake?
Well, we were lucky enough to have Viv Lambert and Mo Choi in the studio, who are the authors of which book, John?
Ooh, let me think. Now, they're the authors of a primary series called Story Central, which I think will be the basis of our theme or topic for today's podcast, which is going to be all about
reading and the benefits of reading, sort of the skills that you need to read, and also some little points on extensive reading and the skills that reading can lead to.
Great. So how's this going to work today, Jake? We're gonna chat a little bit about reading and our input, mixed in a bit with the authors as well.
Yeah, so I recently did an interview with Viv and Mo, and we're going to intersperse that into some questions with some points from John and I about reading and how, and some useful ideas that you can have in your classroom. To start off with, let's hear from Viv and Mo. We are very lucky to have the authors of our Story Central series, Viv Lambert and Mo Choi, in the studio. I don't know why we always say Viv and Mo when we usually do AB follow chronological order, but it's always Viv and
she
Mo.
She always makes me go first.
I wonder why.
I do, actually, because
Mo and Viv. It doesn't quite alliterate as well. Viv and Mo, yeah.
It works, Viv and Mo, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But I always say because Viv has always been lead author when we're together because she has the ELT TEFL background. I'm from a design background. I'm a graphic designer, and I've designed ELT books. So Viv has the
pedagogy, the boring,
Okay. Do you just want to give us like 30 seconds, Viv, of like what's your background in ELT and where you're where you're based?
I'll try.
Yeah. Go for it.
Yeah, it's really nice to be here. Thank you for inviting us. I'm Viv Lambert, and I'm author of Story Central. I've been writing ELT materials for a long time for Macmillan, so you may have seen my name on a few other books in the past. And before that, I worked in-house in a publishing company as an ELT editor. And then before that, I was out there teaching like you are. I taught a lot in Singapore, and then I also taught in London. So I've got some experience of this part of the world, but it was quite a long time ago. So I studied French at university. I'm going backwards, aren't I?
Fine. Continue.
And I've always been fascinated by languages, so I was very happy to move on into a career in English language teaching. And I think I've been very lucky to be able to progress that career into writing and some teacher training, which I managed to do in Oxford, where I'm based at the moment.
Awesome, thanks. And Mo, do you want to start from the beginning and go forward?
I'll do the reverse.
Yeah.
Well, I graduated in graphic design and illustration from Kingston University many, many years ago, and started life as a freelance illustrator, and I then sort of worked at a graphic design company and then got into publishing, moving back to London, working at Dorling Kindersley. I met the lovely Viv, and we worked together on an ELT project there. And basically, we've been working together in some capacity or other ever since. I have worked in ELT publishing as a designer, and then as a project manager, and also now with Viv writing, just more recently on Story Central. It's been fantastic. I've been extremely lucky to be able to move from the design and integrate the writing. I wouldn't say move from, because obviously I still design, but to integrate the two, which is what we always wanted to do, what we always loved, because we felt the two areas were too separate. And as I've said time and time again, visual literacy and text literacy should always work together.
Mm-hmm. And why are you both so passionate about reading? Tell us in one.
Because literacy is the key to learning, and literacy opens doors, as we said before, in all areas of life. I think when you can read, the more you read, the more you can learn about the world.
Do you both read yourselves? Are you both readers?
Yeah, I actually was not really brought up to read fiction much, because I think my family were very keen. I read textbooks. So a lot of my life was spent reading textbooks, and I sort of discovered fiction properly later on in life. I read, things like Pippi Longstocking and Mrs. Pepper Pot, things like that when I was younger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I've become more of a reader later in life, I think.
Yeah, and I studied literature, but French literature.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a time when I read probably more in French than I do in English, but now I just read for pleasure. And I read all kinds of literature, really. A lot of contemporary stuff. And also, I have children at home, so I sort of got back into reading at that sort of young level by reading to them.
Yeah,
and
right.
Discovering, all kinds of brilliant authors.
Mm-hmm.
Like Francesca Simon and Horrid Henry, and I like humour in young children's
so
literature.
You're a fiction fan.
Yeah, I think I am.
I think
yeah.
I'm more on the non-fiction side.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I like to read for the pleasure, but also I want to get something out of it. Like I can go and get some knowledge out of it.
I read for knowledge.
Go and share
lot.
That.
Yes.
Yeah, and that sort of is what motivates me to read. Yeah,
but I also like reading. Much more than just books. I love sort of blogs and just little articles and I almost stack them up ready in my reading list in my browser to read because I think we don't always have to go to books. There's so much text material everywhere.
Don't you think it's the most? I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and actually another Deep Tesla trainer, and he said it's the most exciting time for reading, I think, in the last 100 years, because we read all day, every day. If you're on a train, everyone's sort of anti people looking at their phones, but if they're on their phone reading something, how is that a bad thing? They're reading and they're getting input, and they might be reading, maybe it's news, maybe it's just about the latest cool famous singer or something, but at least they're reading and they're getting something from that, and they're communicating.
Yes.
And I think that, and the blogs. And so many people now can write and share what they want, their ideas with each other through reading. So I think reading is going to explode, going to explode again in the next sort of 10, 20 years through the technology that we have to do that with.
I think so. And that sharing ideas really sort of speeds up your access to knowledge. Rather than having to search things out in isolation, you have everybody else's knowledge from blog posts and experiences that you can just pull together quite quickly.
Yeah.
You just get to your information much quicker, really.
Yeah, and I think because English will become, I mean, it's not will become, it has become the lingua franca, then as ESL teachers, it is our responsibility to ensure that our students aren't reading just for comprehension, but they're also reading for critical reasons, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Which leads me on to the questions I want to ask you today. Cool, so that was an introduction from Viv and Mo, and we'll be hearing some more from them throughout the show today. So, John, what was the first question?
Right, we have, in terms of our reading special, the first question is, what are the main benefits of reading for young ESL or EFL students? Jakey.
What are your thoughts on that, John?
My thoughts? I was going to put that back on you first, mate.
That's all right. I think the main benefits are, one, well, because my experience is in China, so the first benefit is the beginning of reading with phonics, so it learns you how to decode an alphabet, which is this, with Chinese learners having to learn using characters, which is a lot of memory. It all, by learning phonics, it learns you, teaches you how to decode. And the second benefit is that reading is this beautiful, pleasurable thing, and it teaches you without you knowing you're being taught. So I always think it gives you authentic text to teach grammar and new vocabulary without the students even knowing that they're learning English.
Good stuff. Yeah, I want to pick up on that vocabulary. I think later on we'll discuss what skills reading can have a sort of a benefit on as well. I think for me, the main benefits were it can have knock-on effects with all the skills, reading, writing, listening, and speaking.
And even pronunciation, they say.
Absolutely, yeah. Actually sort of seeing it in context can really sort of help the students. But for me, I think I'll hone in on vocabulary and the sort of development of vocabulary. I think it's key at that critical sort of young learner age, getting a strong basis of vocabulary is key, and I think reading can do that. We're going to move on and have a look a little later about a little conundrum there about a vicious cycle or a paradox with vocabulary, and if you don't know vocabulary, how do you read? And likewise. But for me, I think expanding vocabulary is the key benefit there at the early ages. All right. Question two is, when teaching reading to young learners, where should we start? Phonics or whole reading approach or both?
Well, when I first started teaching, there was this massive push for phonics. And you couldn't even sell a course in a school unless it had a phonics component or if the whole course was just phonics. Then what we discovered was happening was that kids were just going into class, sounding out words and saying them. And there was no sort of meaning or anything behind it. So if anyone doesn't know, the phonics debate versus the whole language debate is a sort of an American-style approach, which is looking at the story as a whole, looking at words as a whole, and working with language like that. And phonics is about breaking down each sound. It's a silly debate, really, because basically you should do both, right? You should sound out words, and you should also look at the things as a whole as well. So I don't think it should be a debate, and whenever I teach, you make sure that you sort of integrate these both in together.
Yep, I think I totally agree there, Jake. I think in terms of a whole approach, guys like Stephen Krashen, I think they are advocates of the whole sort of extensive reading and reading as much as you can, so kids can just sort of see, hear, absorb words in its sort of in a holistic way. But I would agree that we need to combine it with some explicit teaching of phonics. I would also add here sight words, like words that you can't actually sound out. We have to learn them by sight.
Can you give me an example of one?
So something like and,
yeah,
right?
Well, you can sound that out.
Yeah.
No, but I know what you mean. And is a sight word.
So I think a lot of schools, some schools I was working with in Malaysia, they had a whole sort of sight word program.
Yeah.
They do that in the UK as well. Because you can't sound them out through this sort of phonics approach. So you need that sort of whole reading approach to help students see those sight words on a regular basis.
Yeah.
To help build up their database of sight words as well, but you know I'm a sporting guy, and when we play sport, we don't put everything together in a final package at once. You need to build up the individual skills in order to put your sort of your final quality sort of package and performance together. So I'm a big advocate of phonics, but it has to go together with or a balance as well.
Yeah, and I think what I noticed when I worked for a school and they were fascinated by these phonics programs, so parents would say, all I want is my child to learn how to read, so then we would spend hours on end teaching phonics. But at the end, I don't think the kids ever knew when they were 5 or 6 why they were learning how to sound out these words, and they missed the point that you were learning to read. And reading, as we said just before, with the benefits, brings pleasure and joy and happiness. So I think if we just focus on phonics, we miss out on all this other happiness of reading as well. And I think kids don't realize that. And it's up to us as teachers to ensure students know why that they are sounding out these words. It's not just because mum and dad want me to.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we have to be quite careful as well. And this goes for native speakers as well as non-native speaker teachers. Is actually, if we're going to be teaching phonics, actually, you know, knowing, you know, the methods of teaching phonics, knowing the 44 sounds of the English language is so important, because we need to be the model for our students as well. And I'll give you an example from, I was in a school in Thailand last week with a group of native, about 40, 50 native speakers, and not one of them knew that there were 44 sounds in the English language. So I think it needs to go hand in hand with a lot of teacher training as well, and bringing teachers, you know, all over the region up to scratch about, you know, the best ways of teaching phonics, but also integrating with that balanced approach, like you said, this whole approach and this love of reading as well.
And for anyone listening today, just a little point that I always hark on about: when it comes to phonics, it comes sound first, then letters, not letters first, then sounds. I think a lot of schools get up and they put up the word, the letter A, and they just say A. But the kid needs to know that sound before they can say the sound. So they need to know the word or where it comes from first. And we need to spend time doing that, phonemic awareness. This will be another episode on phonics. But they need to do all that first, rather than just getting them to be able to write it and say what that letter is. That's not phonics. That's just learning to read. That's just learning to write, right? The main point is having to be able to sound that out on their own and hear that themselves.
Good.
Anyway,
all right. Nice input there, Jakey. Yeah. All right. Let's. I know you're very passionate about your phonics. Okay. Let's move on then to question three. How do you suggest overcoming the difficult vocabulary conundrum? So basically, how to get students reading when they don't have the necessary vocabulary.
This is all you, John, because this is one of your passions, so let's go for it.
Is it? Okay.
Apparently.
So you mentioned the word conundrum. I would call it a beginner's paradox.
Okay.
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah,
okay.
I like it.
So basically, to be able to understand a reading text, maybe in a reading book or maybe through a graded reader, so learners need to have good knowledge of or awareness of the vocab in the text. And if they don't have that vocabulary, they can become very demotivated. Mm. They don't know the words. Okay. So that's quite a difficult situation for a lot of teachers, also a lot of parents to be in. My suggestion for this is one thing that we started doing in Malaysia. We're working with some rural schools there in Malaysia, trying to upgrade the level of their English to help them compete with the urban schools. And what we're doing there is focusing on something called high frequency mm-hmm. words. So these are like the 2,000 most frequent words that come up.
Yeah.
So they say that if you know those 2,000 words, those words will cover around 87% of a non-academic reading text.
Mm.
So if you know those 2,000 words, you're going to be able to understand, you know, a lot of what's going on in a reading text. So that was our first point of call, was to start teaching or develop a syllabus for these high-frequency words to help students or have a knock-on effect with their reading. So they would do a little explicit or direct teaching of these words, stick them up all over the classroom, around the school, so they're sort of frequently seeing or being exposed to these words.
Yeah.
But the key is, when we're teaching vocab as well, students, young kids, they're learning very quickly, but the words are also disappearing out the other ear.
Yeah.
They're forgetting them very quickly. So constant exposure to these high-frequency words through different sort of vocabulary instruction, both explicit and implicit, is a good starting point for me.
Yeah, I think what teachers should do is, when they look at a book, a little tip for you is just read it and say, if I look at a word and think, would I use that word or not use that word? And if you think, when was the last time you used that word? And if it wasn't in the last 3 days, it's probably not very high frequency. Do you know that? And the five finger test, the simple one is, you ask the student to sit down you give them the paragraph and they hold up five fingers. Every time they see a word that they don't know or haven't come across, they take away a finger. If they get down to zero fingers, then that's probably too hard for them to then cope with decoding other bits of vocabulary. So start with very simple things. So when they get to that word they don't know, they can decode it and sort of pull it apart and think, oh, what does it mean from looking left and looking right and in the context of this? Or if I don't know the meaning of it, it doesn't really matter. But once you get over, I think Krashen used to say, over 5% or over 10% of the words, if you don't know them, it kind of loses the meaning of the text.
Yeah, I think that's why you need maybe a very carefully chosen and structured reading program as well, choosing the right balance of graded readers, because you don't want to be students reading texts which are too difficult. Like you said, if they're not understanding the words, they become very demotivated. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the research says that we should be choosing, or the level of the book should be maybe below the level of the students, so they know most of the words, they can read quite fluently, they can build their confidence, they can constantly see all these words being recycled, and they're always exposed to these words, and then sort of take it from there. So not choosing a text that's too difficult, maybe again under their level, and build it up slowly.
And not necessarily having a test at the end of every one, like giving the students a chance to talk about it, discuss it, and talk about it at their own level, which is, rather, I mean, I don't think when J.K. Rowling wrote Harry Potter, she wanted people to do a comprehension test at the end, did she? She wanted them to read it for fun and make lots of money out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so just on that point then, mentioned sort of high-frequency words, if you're not sure what they are or haven't started integrating that into your syllabuses, just check them out. Just Google high frequency words. It will give you a whole word list. Print them out. You can cut them up. Give them to students.
Yeah.
Create a word list for them. And you can always do like 5 words per lesson or something like that. And what's 2,000 divided by 5? How long would that take? My mathematic brain's not on today.
But it is also true that they can be culturally specific. So I'm sure if you did high frequency words in Italy, it might be a little bit different than in China or in Thailand. Maybe rice will come up.
Pizza,
yeah. I mean, every kid in China knows how to say pizza, but they don't know the word for rice, and it's something that they eat every day, which is sort of highlighting how people don't put high-frequency words into curriculums. I think we need to go back and hear what Viv and Mo have to say about some of this stuff.
Should we do that?
Yeah, let's hear from
them. Alrighty.
So you make a good point, Mo, about this idea. If you don't know the word, then using phonics will help you find the word. But then if they don't know that word anyway, then it sort of doesn't have any meaning to them, then we have this problem. So how do you suggest we overcome this difficult vocabulary conundrum? Because in China it's a huge issue where kids just stop reading because there's so much vocabulary they don't know, but teachers are pushing them to read these texts that they need to know. And then they just don't want to read because there's too much vocabulary in there that they don't want to that they don't know. Have you come across this in your sort of teaching careers, or do you understand where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about the phonics is it is all keyed to reading aloud, so you can actually read the word and pronounce it, but you may not necessarily understand what the word means. But I think, it shouldn't be. The problem with vocabulary shouldn't be such an issue if you choose the right material in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's right. There's lots of sort of graded material out there, so graded readers, and if they've been carefully looked at and they should be achievable. But alongside that, I think using real books really helps too. Obviously, you'd grade the activities appropriately to go with them, but I like the idea of exposing children to lots of visual material and working with their visual literacy as well, because, I mean, visual language is a language of its own and we all speak it to some degree or other. And so stories with lots of images, and I mean, a really good example of this is comics and graphic novels. In Asia, they've been popular for so many years, and even in Europe, actually, but England has been very slow to pick up on graphic novels, but they've recently just become really popular. And what I love about them is that you can read the visuals, you can read the story, even without any text. So I think that gives the child a lot of confidence. And so what language there is in there, they pick up from the context, but they pick up from the visuals as well. And so it works together beautifully, and they understand a lot more. It's confidence building. I think likewise, folk tales, so stories they already know, really help with this too, because it's familiar. So they feel
Do you mean stories that they already know in their L1?
Yes, they could be, you know, fairy tales, folk tales from their own culture.
Yeah, because the meaning's already there.
Yeah, they understand it. They understand the context. They can start to understand the words from context too. So.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think Mo's right. I think using visual clues like images in highly illustrated books or comic strip stories, and visual clues of the teacher or storyteller, so using a lot of gesture and facial expression, these all help. But also you can pre-teach some of this key vocabulary up front and some of the grammar, so that they're prepared before you launch them into a story, and also encourage them to read on even if they do stumble over the odd word. And this you can do by setting sort of gist questions at the beginning, or even specific questions, getting them to read for a particular reason and just find the answer to your one little question without worrying about every single word. So yeah, and of course I think this is where scaffolding comes in. Mm-hmm. If you scaffold a lesson carefully, then you're going to ensure that your students are challenged, but they're not pushed out of their depth.
So we hear this word scaffolding a lot now, and it becomes in and out of fashion in teacher training. So how would you describe, or can you explain the term scaffolding for the listeners today, please, guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think it sounds kind of like a big term, but it's actually can be described very simply as the support that's provided by a teacher until the student can work independently. So it is a bit of a buzz term in ELT at the moment, but it really describes the kind of step-by-step guidance that a lot of teachers are doing already. And teachers know what level their class is at. So I think it's starting from the point of what they already know and then assessing, you know, how far you can take them, how much further they can go with your help. So it's a little bit like the scaffolding around a building that helps at each stage in the construction. This guidance and support will help children's learning at each stage. And the important thing to remember is that it's not a permanent structure and it can be taken down, and the teacher should be there to offer the support when required, but then step back when the child's doing okay and let them get on with it.
Cool. Anything else on scaffolding? You sort of that explained what scaffolding is to the listeners, and you're right, it is a lot simpler than it sounds. I think people try to, you know, I did a lot of training for the DIP test, and people try to use a lot of fancy words to describe something that's actually quite simple, isn't it?
It's,
yeah. So, but why is it beneficial to the learners when it comes to reading?
I think it can be daunting to be faced by a whole page of text, and but if the text is carefully chosen, like Mo was saying before, and the students are well prepared and supported throughout where necessary, then I think they might be really surprised at how much they can understand. And again, the visual clues come into it at a young age, I think, using picture books, which we've said before. But careful pre-teaching of the key vocabulary can set them up well. Using the cover, the title, the illustrations to predict what's going to happen in a story. And bringing their own knowledge to the classroom also will help them. You know, if they can relate a story to their own lives, then they're more likely to be able to predict what it's about or what's going to happen.
I think also stories with repetitive nature help too, don't they? Rhyming stories and things like that.
Yeah.
Where they can, you know, they can almost sort of feel that rhythm with it, and then it's easy to join in then when you have the clues from the rhyme as well to, you know, that aids the reading too, I think.
What other skills do you think that prediction helps with?
Um...
I think it allows children to really use their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
Really use their imagination. They start to hypothesize then more. And, you know, they can develop their creativity from that.
Yeah.
So they're not just taking it at face value, I think. So, you know. And it's critical thinking, really, to start predicting and, you know, hypothesizing. So.
Yeah. What I like about predicting is it allows, in classes, allows for differentiation because it allows, you know, every class is mixed ability.
Mm.
And if you allow for that prediction, you can have little Mary just sort of saying, I think she will jump, you know, and maybe Melissa says, I think that she will prophesize about the world or something, you know what I mean? So it allows, because there's no wrong or right in prediction, is there? And that, and it does develop that critical thinking as well, but there's no wrong or right. So it allows for different levels, but still get to that same outcome of make a guess about what's going to happen.
That's it, and they can be as creative as they like at that point.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to a side point. You keep on mentioning pre-teaching vocabulary, and in teacher training, it went out of fashion for a while to pre-teach, and everything had to be set in context. So what's your idea with this sort of, you can still pre-teach, but it can be pre-taught in context, right?
Yeah, I think there are different ways of pre-teaching vocabulary. And again, I think it does depend on your personal situation. I mean, I'm a real fan of teaching using flashcards in the old-fashioned way. But I agree, you don't always want to almost kind of take the fun or the excitement out of the story by having such a slow kind of preamble. Sometimes you do want to just throw them in at the deep end if you've got the visual backup, and you can scaffold in different ways. You don't have to start off by pre-teaching vocabulary. It depends very much on the story, I think.
I just wanted to make the point that I don't think pre-teaching vocabulary is it's not a bad word, you know. Like for a while there, we were shown, for a few years we were taught, don't pre-teach vocabulary, always present in context, always let the students notice and find the language themselves. But there's nothing wrong with, pre-teach them vocabulary.
Well, yeah, but also I think it's finding out what level they're at already.
Exactly.
Which a teacher probably knows their own class and knows what level they are at.
Yeah.
But if there is any doubt, you know, by pre-teaching or just reviewing vocabulary, you may not end up having to pre-teach much of it, because you might just be reminding them of what they already know.
Exactly. So you guys have been authors of Story Central and other textbooks, and you're obviously both very passionate about motivating students to read. I haven't spent long with you, but even just spending the day with you, I can tell you're really passionate about reading. So what are your top tips for motivating students to read in class?
Yeah, I think choosing material, or helping them to choose material that's motivating, relevant to their age and their interests, is a good starting point. Looking at the language level is also key, but remember that they can understand language that's above level they're at in the curriculum when it's in the context of a story. And I think one of the best examples of this is narratives, which always use the past tense. And teachers sometimes say, well, we can't use that because they haven't done the past tense yet. But actually, within the context of a story, and if they can understand what's going on in the story by these other visual clues or other language and vocabulary that they do know, then the past tense being in there isn't going to stop them from enjoying the story and getting a lot out of it.
I think probably providing lots of variety and styles and genre as well really helps, because you've got to keep the children interested, and they all like different things. Yeah. Everybody has, you know, different tastes, really. So really vary the genres. And because I think people have different learning styles too, I think in that respect too, you will get sort of like dynamic images in comic strip, and you will get larger pictorial images, which give more of a story overall. So you've got to appeal to both girls and boys and all ages.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and also I think read a little and often and in a nice environment so that kids sort of think of it as a treat, like songs and games. So, you know, maybe have a reading corner in the classroom and they can sit down on the carpet and sit around you in a circle, perhaps when you do a reading session. And yeah, so they see it as a treat, not as a chore.
You know, I find in... Sorry to butt in.
That's okay.
In China, reading, and a lot of Asian countries, reading is about doing comprehension tests at the end of it. So what kids associate reading with is doing a test. And it's such a sad thing because no one wrote, you know, we know Shakespeare or J.K. Rowling didn't write Harry Potter for people to do a test at the end.
Exactly.
They wrote it for them to enjoy it and have fun with it. And I love what you just said, they read little and often, but in a nice environment, and make them feel like reading isn't this subject. It's a thing that we do for fun. We enjoy it. We do it for knowledge. And why would a kid be any different than an adult? So it's sad that kids don't want to read because they think they have to do a test at the end. Sorry, I was just wanting to add that point because whenever I was teaching here, I'd always sort of make sure I had a part of my class that was reading that they knew there was never a test. There was no test at the end. It was just talk about it. That was it.
I think it's hard to build up that enthusiasm unless you know you're that just reading for pleasure, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think also you could, you know, get them to relate what they're reading to their own experiences and make it more personal too. So it's meaningful. It gives them some choice in what they read if they can, but it gives them a reason to read too.
Last question. What other skills do you feel reading in English can develop?
Well, it's obviously going to develop background knowledge and their global awareness if you are exposing them to different types of story from around the world, for example. And yeah, so not only can they gain knowledge and learn about concepts and cultural information, but reading also develops critical thinking skills, as Mo mentioned before. And critical literacy is sort of going beyond this simple comprehension and testing them on what the story means, and gets them to have a kind of deeper understanding of the text. It gets them to question the text, you know, who wrote it, when did they write it, whose viewpoint does it express, is it fact or opinion? And we think this is a really important skill in these days when there's so much information around us and via, you know, TV, internet and printed materials, and we don't know how much of the information is correct or biased or just out of date.
And I think critical thinking helps us sort of just navigate that maze of information that's out there, because there is so much information. Really getting information off the internet or wherever isn't the problem, but it's really knowing what to do with it, because it's not always right, is it?
No. So I think, you know, the more they read, again, and more different types of material they read, we can use this to explore critical thinking and get them to be more free-thinking and open-minded individuals.
Thanks a lot for coming in today, guys. It's been a pleasure to have two people who are so passionate about reading, and especially for instilling that motivation in kids to read. And we hope we come back again one day. Do you think you will?
Definitely.
I hope
so. Love to. Thank you very much for having us.
Cool.
Thank you.
Great.
All
right.
So what's next, John Craft?
We are going to have a look at our top tips. We got told off for using tips recently, didn't we?
Saying top tips sounds like it's like... one, it either cheapens what we're saying, it's not academic enough, or they said, so then John changed it to instant strategies, or they said it was sort of like, I'll give you a tip, mate, like as if like it's
really
talking down to them or something.
Well, if you don't want useful tips for your classroom, then you can turn off now. For those that you want useful tips for your classroom, stay online, and we're going to have a look at some top tips for motivating students in reading classes.
Uh-huh.
So, I think we're going to have a little look back at maybe some of our experiences around Asia, what we've seen, what we've done in terms of what we can do to motivate our students. So, Jake, you're thinking about back to your sort of China or your experience in China or observing classes in China. How do teachers go about trying to motivate themselves?
Motivate
their kids
to read.
To read.
Yeah, for I'm very passionate about this topic. And about 8-9 years ago, I set up the first time I ever set up a library in a school due to this exact thing that students weren't motivated to read. And so I looked into it and I thought, well, it's not surprising. What happens at the end of a little reading text is they're asked to do a test or a comprehension question. And then what I noticed students were doing was they were just going to the questions first and then going back through the text trying to find the answer. And at the end of the text, I would say, so what was the story about? And they'd have no idea. So this led me to thinking, well, why aren't they motivated to read? Because I'm motivated to read, and there's all this really cool, interesting stuff. So I ended up setting up a library for the students. I started looking at what was extensive reading programs. And if you, I don't know if you know about extensive reading, but extensive reading, very simple idea is it's providing lots and lots of books for students to read in their own time in a comfortable environment. That's the simplest way to do it. So we got lucky. We worked with lots of people to collect books, and we brought them in, and we set up this library. We put out cushions and everything. And what it did was it created a natural environment for the students to want to read, which then started to change their motivation for wanting to read. Number one was giving them choice. So we would call that differentiation now, but letting them, and personalization, but let them choose the book. 95% of classes I watch, the teacher tells the student what to read. But in real life, no one tells you what to read. On the way to work, you're on your phone, you pick what you want to read. When you go to a bookshop, you browse and you choose what you want to read. It's only in school where someone tells you what to read. And that's kind of demotivating if you had to come home every day and someone told you what to read. So number one, the most motivating thing is let them choose. Number two was give them as much choice as possible. Let them, if they want to read about elephants that eat pygmies in the Nile River Delta, that's fine. It can be on any topic they want. Now, that's difficult sometimes to get enough choice, but it's giving them the choice. The next one after choice was they don't have to finish the story. And that was an eye-opener to me, because everybody wants, oh, you have to finish the story or you haven't achieved. But let's be honest, hands up out there, who has started the book and not finished the story? John, have you ever?
Every day, I've got about 5 books on my bedside table at the moment.
But that doesn't mean you're not getting a benefit from the reading, right? And you're not motivated to read. People don't have to finish books, but we have this obsession in education to make people that you have to finish it and then write a report on it. So the other big one was letting them just open it, read it, and don't have to finish it. And then the last thing for motivating them was let them just talk about it with their friends, just like you would in your natural life. You would go and talk to a friend about it. Just let them say something about it. That they were the big keys for me for getting people. And then what we found was after a few weeks of opening this library, there was just not enough places in the library for people to sit, because kids were so into going to this library and hanging out and reading, and they would sit together and collaborate and communicate on books and read together even, and we didn't. So the learning sort of started happening on its own because the motivation came from them.
Good stuff. Thank you. It's very informative, Jake.
Very passionate too.
Yeah,
wasn't it?
I think you are. Yeah. I think it's also key is, you know, those people who are supporting like these reading programs. So maybe teachers, parents. My question is, are they passionate readers themselves?
Yeah, I was going to get to this point. Like, right. Can you continue, sorry.
So, you know, that's very difficult. You know, if they're promoting, or people that are promoting these programs are not passionate readers, it can be an issue. So it's trying to, it's difficult to persuade people, you know, all their lives who are not sort of passionate readers. But that's sort of one point, getting people running these programs who are passionate about reading themselves. I'm also sort of coming from a more sort of maybe public school background as well, where maybe you don't have the space, the environment, or the time, or the motivation for these sort of reading programs. So it's quite difficult.
That's
so
a good point.
I'm trying to think. In Sri Lanka, there was just no time during the day, and teachers were not that interested in setting up their own programs. So we would try and put on before school, maybe half an hour before school. The kids would come in. We'd set up a room, like you mentioned, maybe use some cushions, a nice space. They would come in and do half an hour's reading before assembly. But also using the assembly as a time to really sort of promote reading, or create a really sort of positive,
aura around sort of reading. So during assembly, there would be a little sort of reading recital from one of the students to the rest of the students at assembly. They would conduct a little peer reading for like for about 1 or 2 minutes at assembly as well, based on that reading recital. Little things like that throughout the day, just building up sort of reading as something that's very positive and very important to the school.
And it sounds like it was integrated rather than sort of a separate... Like, it sounds like it was integrated throughout the day, yeah?
Yeah,
that's really
sure.
nice. I like that.
Just sort of putting reading up there as an important thing for the school education. And that seemed to work very well. And towards the end, the students would take more responsibility for that themselves. So they, for example, in the school, they had their own library, and the students would run that library themselves.
Yeah, that's cool.
They would take care of the reading recital at assembly. They would choose who would do it, the peer reading, the... The older students would take care of the younger students and help them with that peer reading. Mm. The reading program in the morning, it was begun by, I think, native volunteer speakers who came over. But by the end, the sixth former students in the school would then run that for the students so it could be more sustainable as well. But like you said, just creating the right environment.
Yeah, talking about integrating it, we used to do this thing where I used to always put a bunch of really simple books, like you said before, lower than the level, in the classroom before I got to the classroom. So any kid that came early, and just put them out on the desk, didn't say a word, didn't talk about it. I guarantee you, if you try this out, after a few weeks, you can't get them to put down the book. They want to come to class early because they want to get the good book that they want to choose. But you don't set it up. You just leave them out. There's maybe a comic. There's one that's a bit heavier, a magazine. And even these little seven-year-olds will come in. And even if they don't know the words, they start flicking through the books, looking at the pictures, talking about it. So they start to sort of interact with it without you controlling it, letting them just sort of control it. And then you can start class and say, okay, books away now. Then when you get to the break time, it's like, okay, guys, you've got a break now. Half the class end up staying and wanting to get the books again because you haven't told them what to do with the books.
Yeah, absolutely. Also some kind of... I like the thought of an end product as well in terms of... In the school in Sri Lanka, they would then vote on their favourite book, and at the end of the term, they would put on a little play around or a little drama production around that book as well. Which was quite fun to bring that sort of that book to life as well in a very sort of creative way, which I thought was really cool.
There was a guy in I was at a British Council conference in Burma or Myanmar, whichever one people choose to call it, and a guy did a really nice presentation on. So at the end of the year, they would all write the kids would get in together and write their own book, even 7 and 8 year olds, so draw the big pictures and write out these sentences, and then he got a publisher, I can't remember who, to print them as big books and then give them back to the school. So then they became the books for the next year's kids to start reading, right? And then it just was this cycle that went on for 5 years. So eventually all these books in the school were written by the kids in the school, and then all you wanted to do at the end of the year was get your book published. And it was a really, really nice program to integrate it. Like, there was reading, writing, collaboration, communication, creativity, all in one thing, all based around reading. It's
fantastic.
Really cool.
Yeah. Brilliant, yeah. Stuff, all right. So last one is, what other skills do you feel reading in English can develop? I think for me, it can develop, I mentioned at the start, I think it can have knock-on effects with all other skills, no?
Yeah.
Speaking, listening, writing, your vocab, your grammar skills.
Yeah.
I think all of that reading can have a knock-on effect on all of those. This was never talked about when we were at school. I wish we had a chance to maybe more sort of visibly learn these kind of skills, these critical thinking, critical literacy skills. But it's something that's very prominent now, and for good reason, right? These are the kind of skills that they're going to need later on in life. So why not start early and develop these things through stories and reading at an early age?
I think the other... I just want to make one last point before the end of the podcast, probably two more, knowing us. One is that reading also... It combats this idea of drip feeding, that so many kids are only doing English an hour a day or an hour a week, and reading can be all day, any day, and it's real and it's authentic. So it means that you sort of turn that tap on of input, and the input is authentic. It's not a teacher standing at the front repeating some sentence over and over again. It's proper, authentic immersion into English, and it can turn the tap on. So it really helps combat drip feeding.
How are the taps in your house? Are they still leaking?
No, right. So I think horrible shower that, like, it goes hot, cold, hot, cold. I told my landlord, but he didn't fix it.
Well, I think on that point, I think we're going to turn the tap off on this on this podcast. Hopefully, I'm not sure if we've solved all your sort of reading problems and issues, but I hope we've given you a few little tips.
Viv and Mo, I'm sure, did. More so than we did.
And, just leads me to say, look forward to seeing you at the next podcast.
Yeah.
So that's all from me, JC.
And me, and check out Story Central if you get a chance, because it's an awesome series.
Alrighty. Cheers.